Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, I will now be continuing with the discourses on the Mangala Sutta. And I just briefly recapitulate, this time very quickly, because I've gone through the ground plan several times already. I guess everybody should have a copy of what I call the ground plan of the Mangala Sutta. And so far we've covered the verses dealing with orientation, establishing secure foundations, preparations, leading a virtuous life in the world, which has two verses, fulfilling family responsibilities, and then becoming a pillar of society. Then we enter with verse 7, we enter the domain of what I call personal ethics which are connected to the world-transcending path. We've now entered upon the beginning stages of the path leading to the supermundane, to the world-transcending goal. And so one undertakes these principles of moral integrity. On the negative side, ceasing and abstaining from evil, including abstaining from intoxicating drinks. Positively, the positive side, being diligent in fulfilling wholesome practices. Then, with verses 8 and 9, we come to cultivating the positive virtues of the spiritual life. Last time I dealt with verse 8, which explains reverence, humility, contentment and gratitude, those are positive virtues, and then also to stimulate one's growth in the world transcending Dhamma, one should from time to time hear the Dhamma, that is, attend sermons, lectures, discourses on the Dhamma. In the time of the Buddha, of course, there were no printed books. So in order to gain access to the Dhamma, one would have to attend discourses. And even now, though books are available, but still, I would say, one cannot depend entirely upon books, but there's a certain, what I call, power of spiritual transmission which comes when one listens to the Dhamma from people who have actually practiced, attained some direct experience, and explained the Dhamma personally through on the basis of direct experience. Okay, today's talk, we come to verse number 9. First, I will recite it in Pali, then give translation, and then give explanation. Kanti cha sova chasata samananan cha dasanang kalena dhamma sakaccha etang mangalamuttamang. Okay, the first word here is kanti, which means patience. Here in the, I'll read the translation that's given in the book. I'm not so satisfied with that. On page 30 in the book, the translation reads, forbearance, obedience, association with exemplars of the Dhamma life and participation in religious discussions, this is the most auspicious performance. I use a different translation. I say, patience, being amenable to advice, or being easy to speak to, seeing renunciance, and timely discussions on the Dhamma. This is the highest blessing. Okay, so the first quality here is patience. And now we have to understand that all of these virtues that are mentioned are preparatory virtues, not simply virtues which have some kind of disconnected role in the spiritual life, but they are virtues which are being tied together, bound together in preparing the mind, making the mind accessible, open to spiritual realization. And so patience also here has that function. And patience is often emphasized, very, very often emphasized by the Buddha, because it's through patience that we are able to make the mind amenable, accessible to the arising of wisdom. In fact, in Pali and Sanskrit, the word, the Pali word kanti, the Sanskrit word kshanti, and even the Chinese word ren, have two meanings, two implications. One is the ordinary implication of the English word patience, but the other sense is that of accepting on trust certain principles that one cannot yet see and verify for oneself. So you have in Chinese renshi, which is based upon the stem for patience. And also ren is used in the technical term in Buddhism to mean accepting something on trust. But patience begins first at the preliminary level as the quality of being able to restrain the mind from the arising and eruption of anger. And the Buddha has given repeated emphasis to the necessity of developing patience. In a famous verse that comes down in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, Kanti paramang tapo titika Nibbanang paramang vedanti Buddha, that patience is the supreme austerity. And so it's through patience, the ability to endure hardships, to endure difficulties, that one develops that steadiness, that enduring quality of mind, that is able to persist along that long, difficult, and very demanding path that will lead to enlightenment, to realization. And so if we are to give a kind of formal definition of patience, we would say that patience is steadfastness. That is, remaining steady, unperturbed, calm and unprovoked in the face of difficult circumstances, and remaining steady, unprovoked in the face of provocation by others. Patience is what protects us against anger and despair. I would say that these are two opposite qualities, two qualities that are the opposite of patience. Usually we think patience is only opposed to anger, but I would say two opposite qualities of patience. One is anger, the other is despair. Anger is our usual reaction against people who disturb us, people who annoy us, people who upset us, provoke us, people who abuse us and revile us. But despair is our reaction towards difficult circumstances, towards hardship, when we feel overwhelmed by our conditions, when we feel that we don't have any control or mastery of our conditions, then we fall into despair, which means that we give up any hope of recovery, any hope of being able to rise up from our circumstances and to master our conditions. Despair, sometimes it can arise from long-term illness, from loss of a job. Sometimes if one fails to obtain the type of career that one wants for oneself, sometimes it can arise from oppressive political conditions, from difficult economic conditions, from harsh climate. But all of these difficult circumstances tend to plunge a person. If the person doesn't have the strength of will, they will tend to plunge a person into despair. And when we try our best to overcome these difficult conditions and we don't succeed, then what protects us from falling into despair is patience, the ability to remain steadfast in our determination to prevail, to triumph. The determination to keep our minds calm and steady without falling into misery and despair. And here, having lived many years in Sri Lanka, and being brought up as an American, I notice that there's quite startling differences between Americans and Asians in their ability to deal with difficult outer conditions. When Americans meet difficult conditions, difficult climatic conditions, difficult economic conditions, very easily they fall into despair. But Asian people, even though they have, I'm speaking from my experience in Sri Lanka, people have been living in conditions of civil war for 18 years. Now it's more than 18 years. But many years of civil war, of ethnic conflict, sometimes very hard climatic conditions. If there's a drought, then there's crop failure, recently tsunami. But still, people are able, in the most difficult conditions, to smile and somehow to find some enjoyment. Even little children, in this country, if the little child doesn't get the computer for its birthday, doesn't get new electronic games, it's miserable and it's upset, it won't go to school, it won't eat supper. But the little Sri Lankan children, they will find little scraps of thrown away paper and plastic that people no longer want, and they'll take them and make them into little toys and play games with them, and they're completely happy. Okay, so patience is the quality that protects us from anger and despair. And patience is a stepping stone. First, it's a stepping stone towards self-conquest. That is, because it is through patience that we can conquer anger. And the Buddha says that the conquest of anger is the greatest conquest. There's a famous verse in the Dhammapada. He says, even though one person might conquer 1,000 men 1,000 times in battle. And this is an age when they don't have remote-controlled weapons. But when you fight a battle, you have to go into the battlefield with your own body, with your own hands, using a sword and a shield to fight. And you fight 1,000 men, defeat them all 1,000 times. And one person conquers, another person conquers only one person. That is oneself. The second person, the Buddha says, that is the greatest conqueror. Okay, so patience is a stepping stone first towards self-conquest, and patience is also a necessary component in harmonious human relationships at every level. That is because no human relationships can ever be perfect, but all relationships, all human relationships are relationships between people. And people always have their imperfections. They have different characters, different desires, different interests. And thus, even the most congenial, the most compatible people are bound to have some disagreements, some diversities of opinion, some conflicts of interest. And when these come into the open, what protects these relationships and keeps them friendly and harmonious is patience. The ability, in this case, to accept the other person for what they are, to accept the situation the way it is. It is patience with the situation, patience with the other person's different points of view, different interests, different likes and dislikes, that prevent these disagreements, incompatibilities from turning into disputes and then from turning into enmity. Then patience is also necessary, and I would say especially necessary when practicing the Dhamma. Because when one practices the Dhamma, one should not expect quick and instantaneous results. But the Dhamma is a long-term process. It's a slow and gradual process of self-transformation, extending over many months, many years, many lifetimes. What we have to do in practicing the Dhamma is to get rid of bad qualities, bad habits, bad defilements. And these bad qualities, bad habits, bad defilements, many of them are characteristics that we have acquired over many years, even over many lifetimes. And so we have to work gradually at eliminating these defilements, eliminating these bad qualities, eliminating these delusions. There's a famous story about there's the Buddhist teacher Asanga, one of the most famous masters of Yogacara Buddhism in India. And he had been meditating in a cave for many years in order to obtain a vision of Maitreya Bodhisattva. And after he had meditated for some time, a few years, I think 3 years, he didn't achieve success. He came out and he saw a man rubbing a stone. And he asked the man, "What are you doing?" And the man said, "I'm trying to make a needle out of the stone." And then Asanga thought, "To make a needle out of a stone, that's going to take a long time. That person, he's just an ordinary worker, a worker, and yet he's so patient that he's going to make a needle out of a stone. And yet I've just meditated 3 years and I'm ready to give up." And so he went back and meditated another few years, still didn't achieve success. Then he came out I forgot how the rest of the story went. But anyway, this shows the need to have patience when practicing. Okay, and how does one develop patience? We can't simply make a determination with the mind, "Let me be patient." But patience arises through practice. And there are two basic principles of practice through which patience can arise. One is the power of reflection. The other is the power of meditation or development. The power of reflection means that when we reflect on things, on situations, relationships, through the prism of the Dhamma, the prism of the Buddha's teaching, then we learn to evaluate our situation from a different angle than we ordinarily do. Usually, when we look at our situation, we do so only from our own very particular, very individualized point of view. Everything revolves around I, and we expect everything to conform to the demands, desires of this I. And so when we get into a conflict in a relationship with another person, we expect that person to yield to our wishes. When we're in a difficult situation, maybe a traffic jam, and we have to go someplace, we have an appointment, doctor's appointment at 4 o'clock, here it is 3:45, and suddenly all of the lights are turning red. Each light that I come to, as soon as I reach the corner, it turns red. It's all a conspiracy to prevent me from reaching the appointment on time. So we start thinking in these terms of the conspiracy theory. But to develop patience in these difficult situations, one has to use the, what I call the prism of the Dhamma, and view situations through the light first of conditionality, that everything depends upon conditions. And so if we are doing things properly and correctly, but things are not going according to our expectations, according to our desires, then we should not become ruffled, disturbed, agitated, and upset, but we consider that the law of conditionality is something fixed and unchangeable. Things are now going against me. Problems with a job, problems with a relationship, maybe a particular oppressive illness, difficult economic conditions in some countries, difficult climatic conditions. We consider this is happening as a result of causes and conditions that I have created in the past, that whatever happens to me is happening, or at least many of the things that are happening to me now, particularly those over which I have no control, are happening through the maturation of my past karma. And so what I have done in the past is bearing its fruits, yielding its fruits right now in the present. And so I just accept what's happening now as the fruits of my karma and don't get upset. But I continue to do good actions now, realizing that those good actions will bring their fruits in the future. So that is reflecting in terms of conditionality. The second principle, a way to view, the second point in the prism is looking at the situation from the standpoint of anatta, of egolessness or selflessness. This is especially helpful in human relationships. Instead of thinking everything has to revolve around the I, look at the situation as many individuals together. I am in relationship to this individual. That individual has their point of view. I have my point of view. None of us is really a truly existing self, but we're all just changing processes, factors of mind, factors of body arising and passing away. All of this is not mine, not I, not myself. What is, goes on in here is no more truly I, truly mine, than what goes on in that person's mind, in this person's mind. It's all equally not mine, not I, not myself. So just look at these disagreements, these differences of opinion, look at them all objectively, impartially, just different points of view. And by looking at them in this way, without identifying with the particular opinions, views that arise in here, then one could put down one's own point of view and consider the other people's point of view. And in this way, one will remain patient. Okay, that is how to develop patience through the power of reflection. But sometimes the power of reflection is not enough. That is why one also has to develop, especially to develop supreme patience, one needs the other force, the power of bhavana, of meditation. Because it's through the meditative mind that one develops the strength of mental mastery, the ability to understand one's own mind and to control the workings of the mind, and eventually, through repeated development, to weaken the tendency towards anger and despair, self-righteousness, whatever, all of those tendencies opposed to patience. And as they become gradually weakened through the power of meditation, eventually they become defeated and can no longer arise and vanquish the mind. Okay, so this takes care of patience. And it is this patience that is especially important in relation to the spiritual life. I have to emphasize this point, because when one undertakes the world-transcending path, then one has to subject oneself to difficult conditions again and again in order to study the Dhamma, to practice the Dhamma. One has to undergo self-deprivation, deprive oneself of the enjoyments that one is accustomed to, the self-indulgences one is accustomed to. One has to learn to live simply. One has to reduce one's desires, reduce one's freedom to indulge one's desires. One has to be able to look upon others as authorities. This is quite against the democratic principle of everybody being equal, which means that all people are equal, but some are more equal than others. And, of course, I am more equal than everybody else. But in following the spiritual life, there is a certain degree of respect and veneration for those who have more experience, more knowledge, more wisdom, more realization. And so one has to be able to accept teachings, guidance from others. That takes patience. The Buddha speaks about how those who newly enter upon the religious life, sometimes those, especially those who go forth, become monks when they're mature adults, will get guidance from youngsters who have been ordained earlier than them, who will tell them, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, this is the right time for this, this is the right time for that. And then they think, what? Here I am, I'm old enough to be their father, and they are telling me what to do. And then they get angry and they give up the monk's life. Okay, so patience is especially necessary now in following this world-transcending path. And that brings us to the next quality, which our translator, Dr. Sadatita, translates obedience. I don't like and don't quite agree with. I prefer to translate it being amenable to advice from others. The Pali word sovacchasata, the stem here is the word vacha, which means speech, plus the prefix su, so you have suvacha. So some people sometimes think it means good speech, being a good speaker, or being a gentle speaker, gentle in speech. But that's not the correct meaning. The correct meaning is being easy to speak to. That is, being one who is willing to accept advice from others, willing to listen to advice from others. And what is meant by this quality is this. When someone teaches you something that's useful to your moral development, to your spiritual development, then you show that you are willing to accept this advice. If you're doing something wrong, and somebody comes, especially somebody who is an elder or superior in the spiritual life, and somebody corrects you, then you are willing to be corrected, willing to accept the corrections. So this quality called being amenable to advice actually combines or brings together three other qualities. What enters into it One is patience, which I just explained, because if a person isn't patient, then when somebody gives them advice, they think, who is that person to give me advice? I know everything. Why, I've been studying Buddhism for 3 months now. I'm an authority on the subject. I did a 10-day Vipassana course. I'm a meditation master. Or when somebody points out errors, mistakes one has made, then one flies into a fury. So if one doesn't have patience, then that's the way one responds. Another quality that goes into this sovacchasata is humility. Because in order to accept guidance, instruction, advice from others, one has to have humility, to be humble. And then a third quality that enters in, ideally enters in, is gratitude. That is, when somebody gives one advice, corrects one's errors, gives one guidance, then one is grateful for that advice. Because one realizes that this advice is truly going to be helpful, truly going to be beneficial. And so this quality of being amenable to advice implies that one has a genuine desire to learn, and that what one wishes to learn is not merely facts, not merely information about Buddhism. But what one wants to learn is how to improve oneself, how to overcome one's faults, one's defilements, and how to develop the dharmas, the good qualities that one does not yet have, but has to embody within oneself in order to reach realization of the dharma, the truth of the Buddha's teaching. There's one sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya which deals in quite extensive detail with this quality of sovacchasata, being amenable to advice. This is sutta number 15. And here the Buddha mentions, or I think it's Mahamoggallana who actually speaks this discourse, he mentions certain qualities of the person who is amenable to advice. He actually mentions some 16 qualities. I'll just mention a few of these. This is the person, when somebody gets advice from others, they don't turn a cold shoulder to the person who gives them advice. They don't get upset and just turn around and walk away as though they don't become indignant and turn around to think, who is that to give me advice, and just walk away. Again, when they're corrected for their faults, they don't turn around and rebuke the person who gives them advice. This is something that we often tend to do. Somebody criticizes us. Instead of stopping to reflect whether the criticism is just or not, we start thinking immediately, well, he's criticized me. In a split second, immediately, one starts thinking of a dozen faults that person has that one has never spoken about before. Now, suddenly, they all start coming to mind, boom, 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 like a machine gun. Well, you didn't do that on this day. And, you know, I bet you never realize you have such and such a quality. I bet you never thought of this, that. So you start rebuking the person who gives advice. The third thing one does is when you're criticized, one starts making excuses. Instead of admitting one has done something wrong, well, you know, on that day, I had a bad headache, or the weather was rainy that day, so I couldn't mop the kitchen. Or there was the flights were delayed at the airport, so so it starts making excuses. Okay, so instead, when one is given criticism, one accepts the criticism, when one is given advice, one accepts the advice, one is grateful to the person who gives the advice, and one expresses appreciation. So this is what is meant by being amenable to advice. The next quality is called samana nancha dasanang. Venerable Sadatisa translates this rather freely: association with exemplars of the Dharma life. But here I think it's valuable, necessary to be a little more literal and translate it the sight or the seeing of ascetics, of renunciants. Okay, the first word we have here, samana nancha dasanam. Samana means one who has renounced the household life, the worldly life. But not merely one who is renounced externally, but it really implies one who is truly renounced outwardly and inwardly. In the Buddha's time, there was a large pool or class of people who had dropped out of the household life to take up this alternative way of life, the life of those who shave their heads, put on ochre or saffron robes, and went seeking the path to enlightenment, the way to liberation. These people were called samanas, in Pali, Sanskrit, shramanas. The Buddha himself was a shramana. To his contemporaries, he was known as the Shramana Gotama. We call him the Buddha, but the other people who are not his followers, we call him the Samana Gotama. And even today in India, there are still such people who are still called, now they call them sannyasis. That word has replaced samana. But in the Buddha's context, the samana means the Buddhist monks. But not just ordinary bhikkhus, but the word samana implies those who are truly peaceful and tranquil through developing higher qualities, developing higher moral training, developing higher mind, developing the higher wisdom. The training of this person has a kind of, can we call it a magnetic influence upon others, a vibrational influence upon others, so that when one sees a person who is true samana, this has a certain impact upon the mind, so that from the way the person moves, the way the person speaks, the way the person's face appears, the facial expression, the manner is mindful, tranquil, composed, restrained. Peaceful, happy, self-controlled, simple, all of these qualities make a deep impact upon the mind. I told you many months ago, I told you the story, my first sight of a Buddhist monk when I was 1965, summer vacation, traveling across the United States from New York to California, stopped in the universe in Madison, Wisconsin. Just spent the night there. The next morning I went for a walk on the campus. The door of a building opens up. That time I just started to read about Buddhism just a few months earlier. Then the door of a building opens up and out comes somebody wearing a robe like this, Asiatic features, East Asiatic features, walking very serenely across the campus. That had such a strong impact upon my mind that it stayed with me for months and months and months. And so the Buddha, in this verse, he says, even the sight of renunciance is a great blessing. And this word here, dasana, is the same as the Sanskrit word darshana. So even today in India, they speak about the importance of getting darshana of an eminent spiritual person, a guru. One goes to get darshana just to see that spiritual person. But for Buddhism, it's not really enough just to see the person. But the Buddha says, seeing is only the starting point. But after one sees this person, it should be followed by approaching, by paying respect, by listening to the teaching. Because the person might be very calm, very impressive, very tranquil, but you go and approach the person and maybe the teaching that they're following is completely wrong. One doesn't know. Don't be impressed by appearances. Then one questions them, and then if from their questioning and listening to the teaching, if you see that the teaching that they are giving out is a valid, seems to be a valid, authentic teaching, then one should follow in their footsteps, practice in accordance with their teaching. Okay, so this is the seeing of ascetic. Then in this connection, I want to mention one practice that takes place in Sri Lanka in the forest hermitages by way of the seeing of ascetics. You see, there are monks all over the country, so it's not very difficult to see Buddhist monks. But there are some monasteries in the forest where monks practice very intensely, practice meditation very intensely. And those are the monks that people really like to see, but those are monks that don't go out and roam around the country. They're quite different from the monks in the village temples, town temples. Of course, they stay in remote, secluded places. But the way the monks in those monasteries get their alms food, there's a system worked out for each of these monasteries where people throughout the island in different villages will register each year. They'll get together, people in a particular village will register to give alms on one day of the year at a particular forest monastery. And so on that day, the people will usually arrive at the monastery in the afternoon, late afternoon. They'll spend the night there. Now, in the monastery, there'll be two areas. One is the area the broad boundaries of the monastery, and at the outskirts of that broad area there will be facilities for these lay people to stay. They're called the dayakas, the people who are to give the alms, the donors. And then there'll be the inner part of the monastery where the monks stay. And the dayakas, the donors, usually don't go inside that part of the monastery. So the people get together, they stay overnight at the monastery. The next morning, they prepare a breakfast, and the breakfast is sent up to the monastery, to the place where the monks stay. But then, for the lunchtime, which takes place, the monks come on alms round at usually about 10:30. There's a kind of wooden block which is sounded. Then all of the monks come out of their huts. They congregate in the alms hall. Then they will come down single file, walking down the steps or walking along the path to the area where the lay people are waiting. And each monk, they walk with their alms bowl, eyes downcast, very slowly, mindfully, coming. The people are lined up with their food. People put the food in the bowls, and then the monks collect their food and go back, and just one monk will stay behind and give a discourse to the lay people. But for the people who have come to give the alms, just having that sight of the monks offering the food becomes a source of great happiness and joy. It's not that they want to talk, chit-chat with the monks, ask what to talk about politics, weather, sports, but just to see them. And it's very impressive seeing maybe 15, 20 monks come walking, each one attending mindfully to his meditation subject, just stopping mindfully in front of each person to accept the food, and then when all of the food is collected, turning around and walking back down the path, back up the steps to go up the hill. Okay, now we come to number four. This is Kalena Dhamma Sakkaccha, having discussions on the Dhamma at the right time. This is very important and very valuable, because it's not enough just to sit passively and listen to the teaching. Not enough just to read about the Dhamma. But it's always useful to meet with one's companions, one's Dhamma companions, those who share basically the same or similar understanding of the Dhamma, and have discussions about the Dhamma. This will bring about there are five benefits in holding discussions on the Dhamma. First, having discussions on the Dhamma will help to increase one's own knowledge of the Dhamma. Because by holding these discussions, one will learn things that one didn't know before. That one also gets from listening to sermons or from reading. But the other benefits are also special. Second, one gets the chance to consolidate and master what one already knows. That is, by exchanging one's views with others, one gets the opportunity to sharpen one's own understanding. That is, one can now, through discussion, one can fine-tune one's own understanding of the Dhamma. One can also see how the principles that one already knows apply to different situations. because now one is getting the teaching not only through one's own, through the mirror of one's own mind, but one is getting it reflected back to you from many different points of view, and that helps to broaden one's own understanding. Okay, then third, having discussions helps one to clear up doubts about the teaching. Because in a discussion, then one gets this opportunity to clear up doubts. But in order to do so, one has to be frank and honest and admit one's doubts. When one has questions, one has to ask them. Don't be shy and frightened, fearful, but be open and ask questions about matters that one doesn't understand. Fourth, through discussion, we come to understand the right way of practice. Particularly through discussion with others, we can see how the way of practice applies to our own specific situation. Sometimes just by getting general advice from a sermon, from a lecture, from a book, doesn't do this. But by discussing with others, we can really find out exactly how to apply the practice to our own situation. And so that helps us to cultivate our minds and develop wisdom. And then the fifth benefit of Dhamma discussion is if we think we have achieved some realization, if we think we've really gained some insight, then it is through discussion with others, through people that we take to be good, knowledgeable friends, that we can determine whether we have truly realized what we think we have realized. Okay, that will be the discourse for this afternoon. Thank you all for listening, and may the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, I'll do the sharing of the merits. Akasata cha bhumatha Devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam akasata cha bhumatha Devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam akasata cha bhumata devanaga mahidika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavata cham hehi Sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe satanumodantu. Sabba sampati siddhya. So if there's any questions based on the discourse, then please feel welcome to ask.
And in this level, in the early teaching of the Buddha, where can we find these kind of resources?
Where can we find patience, Kanta used in that sense? Uh-huh. It does occur. I'd have to... I'll show you some of the sources later. It's a matter just of giving you references.
Because we know we have like a neutral balance.
Which one?
Yeah, right? And
it's used in that same sense already in the early teaching. Mm-hmm. Though when that, of course, Wusheng Fa Ren is a concept of Mahayana Buddhism. But the word Ren used in that sense comes from a very, or Kanti used in that sense, comes from a very early period, from the Nikayas. There are some texts in Anguttara Nikaya, I think even in Majjhima Nikaya, a few places where it occurs in that sense.
I find it difficult to distinguish between being patient and being stubborn.
That's a very good point, yeah. Yeah, because I explained patience. I used the word steadfastness and remaining steady. And also stubbornness also has the characteristic of steadfastness, remaining steady. So it's somewhat not so easy to distinguish patience from stubbornness. But I think through introspection, examining one's own mind, one could tell when one is being stubborn and when one is being patient. And if one has difficulty distinguishing oneself, ask other people, am I being patient or am I being stubborn? And they could tell you.
I wonder if for one is being patient in the practice of Dharma, one should observe some progress. If a person doesn't observe some kind of progress along the way, that should be an indicator that it's not working, the method is not working.
Yeah, though sometimes a person might be looking for certain signs of progress, what they take to be signs of progress. And if they're not getting them, then they think, I'm not making any progress. And so they start losing patience. For example, people who do meditation think immediately that they sit down, their thoughts should come to an end, that they should be able to go into some state of deep, blissful absorption. And after months and months of meditating, still thought they're having trouble with thoughts. And so they think, I'm not successful in meditation. I'm just not cut out for meditation. I don't have enough merits in this life to succeed in meditation. And so then they give up. They lose heart and they give up. They don't realize that being able to work with thoughts is an important part of the practice of meditation. And that just to be able to sit through the process of the mind churning up thoughts, that is a sign of progress. And to be able to sit through the mind that's churning up many different thoughts, that requires patience. If one doesn't have that patience, then one will give up.
We say that patience is something similar to energy. And they are... It all relies on our correct view, because without correct view, the energy or the patience will be and in the wrong direction.
To a wrong direction. I would say that patience and energy have to balance each other. Energy, because if one has, in a sense, too much patience, in a sense, there's no such thing as too much patience, but if one is just patient without energy, then one could just easily just slide into like dull stagnation, just sitting quietly, not really making in earnest effort to advance oneself. Whereas if one has intense energy without patience, then one will drive oneself relentlessly to the point that one burns out and gives up. So energy and patience have to balance each other. But whether patience and energy require the correct view, I'm not sure to what extent they require correct view in the sense of the unique right view of the Buddha's teaching. Since in any system of meditation, any spiritual system, any contemplative path, one requires these two qualities of patience and energy, whether it be the path of, say, Christian contemplatives, Hindu yogic contemplation, Islamic Sufi contemplation, all of them, contemplators, all of the contemplatives in those traditions will also, to succeed, will need the balance of patience and energy. And I think one could find in the contemplative works of those traditions emphasis upon developing and balancing those two qualities, though different terms might be used. But what we might call a special view, the wisdom view of the Buddha's teaching, is quite unique to the Buddha's teaching.
What is the difference between the two principles of the training of patience? You mentioned one is reflection, another is meditation.
Yeah.
Could you please explain more about the two differences?
The difference between them?
Yeah.
I didn't say two differences. I said that these are two principles.
Yeah.
Okay, reflection means patisankha. It's the ability to think, to examine a situation in a particular way. I think... Yeah, I think it would probably be the same as guan cha. Yeah. So it's examining a situation in a particular way in the light of the two examples that I gave, conditionality or dependence on causes and conditions, and anatta, non-self. Meditation means by having previous experience in cultivating the mind in meditation, then when one is in a situation which provokes the mind, which is disturbing the mind, then one is able to withdraw the mind from the disturbing conditions, to draw the mind inwardly, and just one lets the conditions, disturbing conditions, go on, but the mind does not remain agitated. For example, one might draw the mind in if one is accustomed to practicing mindfulness of breathing and somebody is coming, say, and speaking to you abusively, yelling, screaming. One just draws the mind inwardly and focuses the mind upon in-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. Or if one is accustomed to practicing loving-kindness meditation, then one draws upon one's previous development of loving kindness and radiates towards that person loving kindness.
One is about wisdom, another is about,
yeah, reflection relies more on wisdom, more on concentration, yeah. First, let's ask, are there any more questions? Okay, then we will stop. Then we'll have the Pali class at 2:30, exactly 2:30.